Hi, it's Ian Pickus, and we are back in the Congressional Corner today with Tim Versalotti, professor of political science at Western New England University, our big, beautiful friend on the Congressional Corner. Hey, Tim.
No one has ever called me that, so we're already off to a good start. Thank you, sir.
Well, I want to start off and talk about this domestic agenda bill that President Trump wanted passed by July 4th, and he did end up getting the Republicans to stay in line to have the ceremony at the White House on Independence Day. However, I've noted that the bill seems pretty unpopular with Americans, at least right now. What can you tell us about that?
We're still waiting for the first polling post signature on the bill. But polling that was in the field throughout the month of June, in between the House vote and the Senate vote, did indeed find that the bill is not very popular. Among the organizations that were polling was the Pew Research Center. And in their national data, which was from mid-June, 49% of survey respondents opposed the legislation, 29% were in favor, and then another 21% weren't sure. So that 21% may seem like the least interesting number, but it's actually probably the most significant. If one in five people responding to a survey say they don't know, that means that the folks who are expressing an opinion may have a very weakly held attitude about the issue, and something like legislation, which is a moving target, would certainly fit the bill for that. So opinion's fluid, and what we do know from the polling prior to the final passage is that either a significant plurality or upwards of a majority of Americans really didn't see anything in the bill for them. There was no obvious benefit if you were a middle class voter, working class voter. The news coverage stressed that the tax benefits would go to the super rich in the country. There were some things that the president has tried to argue will filter down. One is in terms of not taxing tips for individuals who are in jobs where they are routinely tipped, such as waitstaff, for example. And the argument that there would be a break on Social Security taxes. Now, we need to be careful about that. What that simply did was provide a reimbursement to seniors on Social Security. The actual tax on Social Security is not touched by the legislation. So there is nuance on the tipping taxes. You have to itemize, and a lot of people who are in professions that are tipped regularly may not have enough deductions mm-hmm. to exceed the standard deduction, which has gotten pretty substantial. So that lack of tax on tips may be illusory for a lot of folks as well. So bottom line, at least up through the final passage, a lot of Americans looked at this and said, well, there really isn't much in there for me, and therefore it's not something I'm going to support.
So let me ask you then about first President Trump and then the Democrats. Now, in his first term, Trump was not able to get a legislative achievement like this. I mean, every week was Infrastructure Week, and the Republicans in Congress at that time were largely seen as throwing up some roadblocks to his agenda. So does this look like a significant win for the president this time around?
It does. And if we focus in particular on health care, what we see in this legislation now signed into law is that there will be significant cuts to Medicaid. These cuts won't take effect until after the 2026 midterm election. And that's obviously by design to minimize the political fallout from the cuts. But what they do is roll back the expansion of Medicaid that was possible under the Affordable Care Act. People may recall from President Trump's first term that Republicans in Congress tried repeatedly to repeal parts of the Affordable Care Act. It came up short every time. This legislation helps them to achieve some of that. So it is not as obvious, and my explanation of it, for example, takes up a lot more time than simply saying, oh, Obamacare is overturned. But through clever legislation, the Republicans have achieved a policy objective that the president could not reach in his first term.
And that leads me to my follow-up question about the Democrats. Democrats in the Northeast and on this show say, well, once voters get a whiff of what this bill includes, they are going to take it out on the GOP in the 2026 midterms. Does that seem likely to you? I mean, we're talking just after the 4th of July in 2025. As you say, a lot of the impacts are after the next election. So if you were running a Democratic campaign for the midterms, would you center opposition to this bill as kind of a rallying point?
I would zero in on a couple of things. One is healthcare. Although the cuts won't take effect until after the midterms, hospitals have to do long-range planning. And so hospitals will be looking at the revenue stream that is ahead for the next 5 years, for example. And so there may be changes that occur before the actual cuts take effect. And for example, here in Massachusetts, the Mara Healey administration estimates a quarter million people on MassHealth, which is the Medicaid plan in Massachusetts, will lose their health coverage. You can bet that Democrats will be hammering that home over and over. And those examples exist in every state in the country. So it's going to be about messaging. One thing we also know from political behavior research is that voters don't always connect their personal circumstances to the choices that they make. They tend to think of their circumstances as unique and not something that may be common across a wide swath of the population. So it really is up to the Democrats to be aggressive and consistent and loud on this messaging in order to hammer it home.
Do you ascribe to the traditional view that the midterm will favor the Democrats just because they are the minority party and it's halfway through a Republican term?
It 10 years ago, I would have said, "Oh yeah, absolutely." We see though that circumstances are such that things can happen that upend that conventional wisdom. But what we do know is that control of the House of Representatives in particular hinges on just a handful of seats flipping. And preparing for this recording, I was looking at the generic ballot. It is if the election for the Congress were held today, would you vote for the Democrat or Republican candidate in your House district? That measure has swung 5 points in the direction of the Democrats since the November 2024 election. They will be on the ascendancy here, and it won't take much. The Senate, a bigger challenge. 35 seats are up. Republicans are defending most of them, but not a lot of flippable seats. And the Democrats would need to flip four and defend all of the seats that they hold. So, bit trickier. But the House, oh, the House is doable if we continue on the trajectory that we're on right now.
Tough sledding in the upper chamber, that's for sure. It's Ian Pickus, and we are back in the Congressional Corner today with Tim Versalotti, professor of political science at Western New England University. So, Tim, we had some high-profile primaries in New York State in June, and in New York City, a Democratic socialist won the primary for mayor. Do you take any meaning from that result about where the Democratic Party is? This was one of the first big elections since the November 2024 party wipeouts by the Dems.
Yeah, a lot of tea leaves are being read right now, and it's good to reflect on what the off-year election cycle offers us. So, the year after the presidential election, there are really three high-profile races that partisans on both sides look at: the governorships in New Jersey and Virginia, and mayor of New York. Now, we have to offer all kinds of cautions and caveats. It's an off year. People aren't paying as close attention to politics as they would in a presidential election year. There's a certain amount of fatigue, a sort of hangover from the big presidential election cycle. But this is also a time when the parties will shop around some messaging, some strategies. They may do a little bit of experimentation. And that's what makes these races kind of interesting to watch, to see, well, what might this tell us about next year, the 2026 midterms? So, New York City in particular is a tricky one to extrapolate from in terms of the nation. No question about it. And I have to be cautious here because my expertise is not necessarily in New York City politics. So I want to stay in my lane and not get too far away from what I know. But in the coverage that I have read since the mayoral primary in New York City, one of the takeaways is really about political communication. And that is something that could be transferable across other races, other jurisdictions. And what individuals are coming away with is that Soran Mamdani was very effective at not just communicating through his social media posts, his videos, but also spending a fair amount of time listening and conveying that he was listening, that he was listening to voters and not to consultants, not to pollsters, not to the professionals who would prefer that candidates not get too far out there. And although we don't have exit polling per se that gives us an insight, we do see, at least in the voter turnout data, there was higher than usual turnout among younger voters, voters ages 18 up through 34. That is the holy grail for the Democrats right now, because that demographic, when it did turn out last year, did not turn out in favor of the Democrats necessarily, especially young male voters. So this campaign, the Mamdani campaign, is going to provide a case study for how to communicate with a sense of authenticity and empathy. The actual ideas are, again, really hard to translate across jurisdictions, but the means of forming and delivering those ideas, those could be some useful lessons moving forward.
And based on that data, it leads me to this next question I have for you, which is, anecdotally, and people know that I work in this industry, I hear from a lot of folks right now that they just have kind of tuned out a little bit. It's too much of a fire hose from Washington. The political news and the war, it's a lot to take in on a daily basis, and they're just not paying attention the way they might have in the past. If you're saying that Mamdani was able to connect with a demographic that typically might not show up at the polls, maybe those anecdotes aren't exactly true, at least in New York City.
Yeah, it could very well be. It may also be that it's the power of social media. We both, you and I both work with college students, and they are on social media. I won't say 24/7, they do sleep, but my students keep their notifications on and their phone right by them. They tell me this, and I say, that's a terrible idea, especially the night before an exam. But FOMO, fear of missing out. What if I miss something? So, when you meet voters where they are, and it appears that Mamdani did, you have a lot of potential to excite people, to get them out, or at least get them talking. and paying attention. And so, although I would agree with you that people who follow politics for a living, who are active, who are the ones who go to town halls, who go to demonstrations, they may be feeling a bit either of fatigue or a sense of being overwhelmed because the issues just come fast and furious. But the folks who've been sitting on the sidelines, whoever can find a way to not just reach them, but let them know they're being heard, that they're being taken seriously. Wow, that's a recipe for success. And I think we're going to see a lot of folks looking for that in these off-year campaigns, tinkering around the edges a little bit. Candidates are very risk-averse. If you approached a candidate and said, "I'd like to do a double-blind experiment with your ads this cycle," they're not going to be very excited. And it's been tried by political scientists. But around the edges, if you say, "Look, this isn't going to cost a lot of money, it's not going to put a lot of resources at risk, could we tinker a little?" Well, there might be some useful lessons to learn going into the much bigger 2026 midterm cycle.
You know, it seems to me, based on everything that you're saying, that performance of the job and image really is everything. If you look at where the Democratic Party went so wrong in 2024, people watched that debate and they made a conclusion that Joe Biden didn't have his fastball anymore. That was not a policy-based conclusion. It was looking at a screen and, you know, seeing one candidate who had vim and vigor and one who clearly didn't anymore. And I don't know if, I mean, I don't work in politics, but as someone who watches it closely, I would definitely take a lesson from that. You know, Mamdani was able to project a youthful and fun campaign against a Cuomo who was often dour and not showing up in New York to big
Yeah,
events.
and that is a dynamic that we did also see at the national level in 2024, especially for marginal voters and especially for young voters. It was the same old, same old. We had Biden Trump, a rematch of 2020. And voters who aren't showing up regularly or citizens who aren't registered, they're frustrated. They want change. There are real problems facing the country right now. Housing is just out of this world in terms of rents or purchasing a house. Healthcare is difficult to access. Try getting an appointment with a primary care physician on short notice. There are, and these things don't seem to be changing or improving. And so a candidate who is not associated with those issues, not viewed as part of the problem, really has an opportunity right now. The challenge, though, then is delivering. And with Mondami, the ideas that he has, delivering on those ideas, those are not going to be easy based on what I've read. At least now, coming out and saying, "I hear you. Here are a couple of very straightforward, simple things we could do to make your life better." Ooh, I think voters are desperate to hear that, and more would start tuning in if they heard that message.
Ian Pickus here in the Congressional Corner. We're speaking with Tim Versalotti, professor of political science at Western New England University. And Tim, Massachusetts has some big races coming up in 2026. Let's start with the race for governor. Governor Maura Healey already has some would-be contenders standing in her way as she runs for re-election. So, who are some of the personalities?
Yeah, so on the Republican side, two candidates have declared so far. Mike Keneally, he was Housing and Economic Development Secretary under in the Baker administration. And then Brian Shortsleeve, a venture capitalist. He was chief administrator for the MBTA, which is the regional commuter rail system for suburban Boston. Keneally is viewed as more of a moderate Republican when asked who he supported in the 2024 presidential election. He said he left his ballot blank. He couldn't bring himself to vote for Donald Trump. Brian Shortsleeve, on the other hand, said he absolutely voted for Donald Trump. He wouldn't shy away from that at all. So they will provide voters with a real contrast in terms of their politics. They're both focusing on affordability issues, which I think will dominate the governor's race next year. They're focusing on housing affordability. They're focusing on transportation improvements. They're focusing on finding ways to make Massachusetts more welcoming to businesses. And I would fully expect that is the agenda they would pursue running against Maura Healey.
Now, Healey did something that hasn't been done in a long time, which is sign an on-time state budget. 14 years, I think. Will that redound to her success with voters?
It's interesting. We've recorded in past years during budget stalemates, and you get weeks into the new fiscal year, which at the state level in Massachusetts starts on July 1, and there's no budget, but there are continuing resolutions, and so state services continue to be provided. And I think sometimes the hitting the budget deadline is more a focus of those of us who watch government and politics than ordinary citizens. But sure enough, the budget came in for Healey's signature on July 4th, and there was a desire on her part, according to media accounts, to make sure she signed that budget on the same day that President Trump signed the tax and spending legislation that he called the Big Beautiful Bill, to draw a contrast between what the state would be doing for its residents versus the cuts that Massachusetts might face under the legislation that President Trump was signing on the same day. So, in that regard, she can point to the achievement as saying the government got its homework in on time. We got a spending plan in place. And so I do think there was some perceived political benefit in getting it done on time.
So Healey is a former state attorney general. We've got a current state attorney general, Andrea Joy Campbell, who has launched a number of lawsuits or joined lawsuits against the Trump administration. How are the two of them handling this Trump 2.0 term?
Yeah, it's very interesting to watch how they differ in their approaches. When Maura Healey was attorney general during the first Trump term, she sued the Trump administration, often in concert with other state attorneys general around the country, multiple times. As of early June, Andrea Campbell has joined lawsuits against the Trump administration on 20 occasions. And these range from shutting down offices like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to the concern about due process rights for individuals who are being seized in immigration raids. So in that regard, Campbell is doing what Healey had done in the first Trump term. Interestingly, though, Campbell and a number of other of her colleagues across the country have also said it's not just spending time in the courts, it's also trying to replace the services that are being lost at the federal level. So Campbell has talked about providing consumer financial information at the state level to take the place of what was being offered by the Federal Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The attorneys general have talked about watching out for price gouging in the wake of tariffs. So if goods are being imported and their prices are off the charts, to accommodate those tariffs. The state attorneys general want to make sure that these prices are not out of this world in terms of taking advantage of the situation. So it's more a service provision approach, as well as the sort of big headlines go to court and make arguments. Now, a governor is in a different situation. And Maura Healey has made no secret of that. Governors need things from presidents. And if a natural disaster strikes your state or there's a terrible accident of some kind, you're going to need federal resources. And so Healey has said that she wants to work with the president when she can on behalf of the state. She told the New York Times in an interview in early March, if the president is going to work and support the state of Massachusetts, I will work with the president and federal administration. When he's not, then I will be the first to stand up and fight for the people of Massachusetts. So that's her governing philosophy, and that's generally what she has done so far.
Well, let's talk about another Democrat who is on the ballot next year, and that is Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey, who, as we speak, is turning 79 years old, which means he would be 80 next year while running for a new 6-year term. He has been locking up support. How's he looking for re-election, Tim?
So there hasn't been a whole lot of polling yet on the race, but the University of New Hampshire's Survey Research Center has been polling in Massachusetts pretty regularly. And in a poll that they put in the field in May and reported at the end of May, one of the questions was, U.S. Senator Ed Markey has announced he will seek re-election to the U.S. Senate in 2026. Generally speaking, do you think Ed Markey deserves or does not deserve to be re-elected as a U.S. senator? Here were the numbers. 33% deserves, 43% does not deserve, but a full 25%, 1 in 4 voters, said they didn't know. So we have to take that with some caution. It's very early. People aren't thinking about the 2026 Massachusetts Senate race at the moment. Markey is very popular. He is rolling out endorsements. The congressman from the first House district, Richie Neal, led a series of state and local politicians who endorsed Markey in recent days. Markey's rolling out endorsements from the eastern end of Massachusetts as well. And he's got some money in the bank in terms of his campaign treasury as well. He's a pretty good fundraiser. He raised and spent about $13 million when he ran in 2020. He's got $2.29 million cash on hand as of late March, and he could ramp that up pretty quickly. Who might oppose him on the Republican side? There are no clear front runners at the moment, but John Deaton, an attorney and cryptocurrency advocate who ran against Elizabeth Warren last year, has said he is considering getting into the race. And there have been some media reports of some polling that indicates when Markey's age is stressed in polling questions, his support diminishes somewhat. So we could expect that any Republican running against Ed Markey next year will be focusing in on that issue for sure.
Well, it was a bit of a fever dream period in politics, but I seem to recall Joe Kennedy III making a generational run against Markey the last time around in a Democratic primary. And surprisingly, I guess to some, Markey was able to harness a lot of youth support and turn that challenge away.
Ed Markey has an interesting campaign persona. If you've gone to a town hall and heard him speak, he's tells stories. He's like a grandfather regaling the family at the dinner table, and he connects with young people. He's kind of a quirky guy. And so, that generational argument didn't land very well in 2020. And it was kind of reminiscent of the 1984 presidential debate where the question of Ronald Reagan's age came up. And Reagan said that he would not make an issue of his opponent, Walter Mondale's, youth and inexperience. We could expect Senator Markey to recycle that argument next year, I suspect.
Remember when that counted as a great political one-liner? I mean, we'll never get back to that.
Sure. Now, those were the days for sure. What Ed Markey does say over and over, it's not your age, it's the age of your ideas. And that has been a mantra for him since he introduced with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez the Green New Deal when he was running in 2020. And so I think that is an argument he will continue to make next year as well.
We always love catching up with Tim Versalotti, professor of political science at Western New England University. Tim, thank you for your time and insights.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Ian.